Herzlich willkommen zu Seiten der Gegenwart. Heute mit der Blauen Stunde im Gespräch ist der Surkamp-Verleger Jonathan Landgräber mit der israelischen Historikerin Fania O. Salzberger, die im Sommer einen Vortrag in Konstanz gehalten hat, auf dem basierend ein Buch geschrieben hat, Deutschland und Israel nach dem 7. Oktober, geht weit über den Konflikt hinaus und gibt tiefe Einblicke in eine Gesellschaft, Verwerfungen und eine aktuelle politische Situation, die uns täglich beschäftigt.
Ja, liebe Gäste, ich begrüße Sie sehr herzlich zur Blauen Stunde mit Fania O. Salzberger. Sie wurde 1960 geboren als älteste Tochter von Amos und Nia Oz. Sie ist Historikerin, Intellektuelle und emeritierte Professorin für Geschichte an der Juristischen Fakultät an der Universität Haifa, inzwischen emeritiert, und engagiert sich in der israelischen Protestbewegung für Demokratie und seit dem 7. Oktober für die liberale und gemäßigte Bewegung in Israel. Ich glaube, ich brauche dich, liebe Fania, eigentlich gar nicht vorstellen. Ich freue mich sehr, dass du da bist. Vielen Dank, dass du gekommen bist und dass wir die Möglichkeit haben, dieses wunderbare und wichtige kleine Buch, was du im August und September letzten Jahres verfasst hast, dass wir das hier über dieses Buch gemeinsam sprechen können, über Deutschland und Israel nach dem 7. Oktober, das verbunden mit der Idee und der wichtigen Idee, dass es ein Gespräch öffnet, ein wirkliches Gespräch öffnet zwischen Deutschland und Israel, was es vielleicht nur selten gab, vielleicht nie gab, was aber in jedem Falle dringender notwendig ist denn je. Und dieses Buch von Fania beginnt mit den Sätzen, dass es eine Einladung an ein deutsches sowie ein internationales Publikum ist, in einen Dialog mit Israelis zu treten, vor allem mit dem Teil der israelischen Gesellschaft, der, wie sie schreibt, wie ich, zionistisch und liberal gesinnt ist, friedenssuchend und der Demokratie verpflichtet. Das ist das Alleinstellungsmerkmal dieses kleinen Buches, dass sie diese Diskussion so explizit mit dem deutschen Publikum führt. Fania spricht fantastisch Deutsch und trotzdem haben wir uns darauf geeinigt, nicht den Abend auch auf Englisch zu bestreiten. Wir beginnen mit einer kleinen Lesung aus dem Text von Irene Baumann, die uns hineinführt direkt in die wesentlichen Themen dieses Buches.
Meine Stimme in diesem Gespräch ist weder objektiv noch neutral. An diesem schwarzen Samstag verloren mehrere meiner engsten Freunde und Kollegen durch die schrecklichsten vorstellbaren Taten von Hamas und islamischem Dschihad ihre Liebsten. Eine Katastrophe ist über uns hereingebrochen. Hat diese Katastrophe meine menschliche und politische Persönlichkeit verändert? Ja, definitiv. Sie hat mein Bewusstsein für das Böse geschärft, das von unseren liberalen Sozialwissenschaften ignoriert wurde. Sie hat mich jedoch nicht in einer Weise verändert, die mich zwingen würde, mein politisches Engagement und meine Hoffnung aufzugeben. Was als schockierend bösartiger Angriff auf Zivilisten begann, wurde zu einem schlimmen Krieg unter der schlechtesten Regierung in der Geschichte Israels. Israel war am 7. Oktober nicht in seiner Existenz bedroht, doch wegen der rücksichtslosen und gelegentlich kriminellen Kriegführung dieser Regierung, ihrer selbstzerstörerischen Außen- und antidemokratischen Innenpolitik stehen wir heute tatsächlich vor einer existenziellen Bedrohung. Nicht seitens der Hamas oder der Hisbollah und nicht einmal seitens des Iran, sondern von innen her. Doch ebenso wie die Kibbuzim ist das liberale Israel immer noch lebendig. Seine Werte sind zu stark, als dass sie leicht überwunden werden könnten, weder von der Hamas noch vom jüdischen Ultranationalismus. Benjamin Netanyahus Koalition biedert sich den Extremisten an, die er verantwortungslos in sein Kabinett geholt hat, um seine eigene politische Haut zu retten. Das Verhalten meiner Regierung im Krieg, in der Außenpolitik und nicht zuletzt in der Innenpolitik erfüllt mich mit Scham, Abscheu und dem Wunsch nach einem demokratischen zivilen Ungehorsam. Mein erster und entscheidender Punkt: Jeder Hauch einer realistischen Hoffnung auf eine politische Übereinkunft in unserer Region in den letzten 40 Jahren, einschließlich der Oslo-Abkommen und des nachfolgenden Dialogs, basierte auf dem Modell zweier benachbarter souveräner Staaten, Israel und Palästina. Dieses Modell ist nicht nur pragmatisch, nicht nur human und liberal, sondern auch, Sie mögen überrascht sein, das zu hören, seinem Wesen nach zionistisch. Nicht, dass viele Israelis es zum gegenwärtigen Zeitpunkt unterstützen würden. Auch eine große Mehrheit der Palästinenser lehnt es rundheraus ab. Beide Seiten sind allzu traumatisiert und radikalisiert, um über eine friedliche Nachbarschaft oder gar einen gemeinsamen Staat nachzudenken. Die Ein-Staat-Lösung, wonach alle Israelis und Palästinenser in Zukunft glücklich und zufrieden in einer gemeinsamen Zivilgesellschaft zusammenleben sollen, ist nach dem 7. Oktober für unsere Generation gestorben. Die Zwei-Staaten-Lösung ist dagegen gesund und munter und wert, dass für sie gekämpft wird. Sie wäre für beide Seiten ein harter, fast schon unerträglicher Kompromiss, aber ihre Realisierbarkeit ist unsere große Hoffnung. Bitte hören Sie auf die gemäßigten Israelis. Es gibt Millionen von uns. Wir sprechen nicht alle mit derselben Stimme, aber wir alle sind gegen die Stimme, die Prioritäten und das Handeln der heutigen Regierung. Bitte verstehen Sie den Unterschied zwischen der ultranationalistischen Usurpierung des zionistischen Vermächtnisses und unserem eigentlichen Zionismus, der realistisch, pragmatisch, sensibel und im besten Sinne human ist. Unsere korrupte Regierung schürt in den chaotischeren Teilen des Internets den innenpolitischen Hass. Aber wir sind keine moralischen Ungeheuer und unsere nächsten Wahlen, hoffentlich lange vor dem gesetzlich vorgesehenen Termin im November 2026, werden zeigen, dass die Hoffnung den Sieg davontragen wird. Der deutschen Regierung und anderen guten Freunden sage ich, Benjamin Netanyahu und seine Koalitionspartner sind kein Symbol für Israel und die Israelis mehr. In der Geschichte der Nationen kommt es vor, dass der Herrscher nicht länger für das Wohl seines Volkes steht. Bitte tun Sie uns den Gefallen und unterscheiden Sie zwischen der israelischen Regierung und der Mehrheit der israelischen Gesellschaft. Noch wichtiger jedoch, bitte reichen Sie den palästinensischen Gemäßigten in den besetzten Gebieten und der Diaspora die Hand. Wir wissen nicht, wie viele es sind, da sie gegenwärtig mit wenigen bewundernswerten Ausnahmen aus Angst schweigen. Die globale Gemeinschaft muss ihnen helfen, wieder eine Stimme zu finden und vor allem muss sie versuchen, sie vor den Morddrohungen ihrer sogenannten Brüder zu schützen. Bitte schützen Sie auch sie vor ihren Millionen falschen Freunden in aller Welt, die in ihrer Hast und Unwissenheit nicht sie, sondern ihre mordgierigen Brüder unterstützen. Etwa ein Viertel der Israelis, Juden wie Araber, unterstützt inzwischen die Zwei-Staaten-Lösung. Mehr als die Hälfte wäre bereit, einen langsamen und vorsichtigen Prozess in diese Richtung in Gang zu setzen, sofern es genügend internationale Unterstützung, Sicherheitsgarantien und eine erkennbare Deradikalisierung der Palästinenser in Gaza und der Westbank gibt. Unter diesen Voraussetzungen ist die israelische Gesellschaft immer noch in der Lage, das Skalpell an den eigenen Körper anzusetzen und alle oder die meisten Siedlungen in der Westbank aufzulösen, als Gegenleistung für eine sichere und stabile Aufteilung unseres wunderbaren Landes. Israel kann das tun. Wir müssen hoffen, dass auch die Palästinenser es tun können. Und dieselbe Hoffnung wünsche ich Ihnen allen. In Ihrem Kampf gegen Extremisten und Fanatiker in Ihrem Land, uns allen, viel Glück.
Fania, when you wrote these words in last summer that you now chose to be read and that lead us right into the political discussion, from today's perspective to find into our conversation, do you think things have changed between last summer and now?
So, guten Abend, Shalom. Ich freue mich und ich bin auch traurig, hier zu sein. Herzlichen Dank an meine Gastgeber. Ich könnte Deutsch sprechen, aber nicht so nuanciert wie Englisch. Und heutzutage brauchen wir Nuancen. So I will be talking in English with apology. And I would also like to say, Jonathan, if I may, to begin with, that the first time I stepped on this beautiful carpet, it was in the home of Siegfried Unfeld, Unseld and Ulla Berkevich, many, many years ago. And in retrospect, I understand that the unique friendship between my late father and Siegfried Unseld was one of the building blocks of the whole German-Israeli story post-war, the great friendship. And I cherish the memory. Not enough has changed since last August. And I would have written the same text more or less today, unfortunately, because We were all expecting that the Netanyahu government would topple quite soon after the 7th of October, and that never happened. In the meantime, Israelis like myself have to fight three different wars. Definitely against Hamas and Hezbollah and other terror groups. But also against our own government, which is the worst government in Israeli history by far now, and it's still there. And the third war is against the global attempt to cancel Israel as an entity, as a political society, as a legitimate state. So if I may start with a little anecdote. Exactly a year ago, Ellie and I, Ellie is sitting here, were in New York for what was supposed to be the gala of a new off-Broadway show based on my father's book, novel, A Perfect Peace. Can't remember the German title, but A Perfect Peace in English, about a kibbutznik and former soldier who is coming out of his fixed idea fix in order to understand the world and humanity better. We landed in New York for the gala, for the first evening, and then we were told that the whole show was cancelled because some of the actors in the cast did not want to be identified with Israel or with Amos Oz. Fortunately, we were able, both Ellie and I, to speak in a closed meeting, otherwise it would have been disrupted by demonstrators, with academics, with journalists, and explain, give our voice, which is also my father's voice, of liberal, moderate Israel. So it was not a wasted trip. But when I think about a world in which Amos Oz is cancelled, or moderate Israel is cancelled, it makes me shudder. So yes, the book unfortunately still stands and is still valid for today.
You are and you act as the voice of the liberal Israel. And in the section we heard that was read out, it still says that the evil was not taken into account by liberal social sciences. That's what you write in your book. Can you explain that in more detail, what you mean by this?
Well, there were many conversations going on, myself and my father, about the concept of evil. Ever since I was in the kibbutz high school and he was the teacher and he taught us Dostoevsky. And I remember him telling us, evil really exists in the world. It's not all about victims trying to revenge because of their victimhood. It's not all about environment and culture and education. There is also real evil and really evil people, not many, but there are in this world. I think that the 9th of October has changed me in this sense. That yes, some things are truly evil, not only on the Palestinian side, not only on the German Nazi side, also in my own society and in many liberal Western societies. It is because we haven't faced up to evil that our Western democracies are tottering these days, unraveling these days. Liberals have to either to reinvent their liberalism and their civic commitment. That was my Doktorarbeit I wrote about the civic spirit and the German Bürgerlichkeit, as it was understood. If we do not wake up to defend ourselves and democracy, democracy will not continue. If we do not reinvent liberalism, liberalism and humanism would not continue. So it's up to us and the younger generation. This is why I'm here. This is why I'm speaking wherever a microphone is offered to me.
In the text you say, so the liberal social sciences and you ignored the evil. And when we talked before we now sit together here, you said again, in your opinion, and also what happened to you in New York last year, that we have been too liberal on both sides, left and right. And you see that we are endangered of losing our liberty and our liberalism towards both of these poles.
Yes. Well, on this, unfortunately, Israeli society was a pioneer. We were pioneers in several ways, but also in the rise of vitriolic right-wing populism. And for many, many years, the liberals, the liberal democrats, not only in Israel, but Israel led the way, have been far too forgiving towards the nationalist right, towards religious extremists, and also, may I add, towards the extreme left, the woke culture that emerged from liberalism. It's kind of a child, but a very misconceived child of liberalism, and gone over to the other side, abandoning universalism, abandoning die Aufklärung, and giving themselves to an identity politics in which the victim is always right and the colonialist is always wrong, and we decide who is the victim and who is the colonialist. This too was a mistake of liberals. Either we regain the conversation or we get off the stage of history.
I'm sure this can trigger a lot of contradiction, what you just said, but I want to go on and ask, if you look at the situation now, at the polarization of the Israel society, but particularly of the Netanyahu government, your words in your text are already very, very direct, in a way direct that in Germany many people would have difficulties to express in the same way. And also here again, is that anything changed since last summer until now about the Netanyahu government, or is it just getting worse and worse?
Yes. Well, they're certainly holding on power, and not a single member of the ruling coalition has withdrawn as a reaction to the greatest calamity in Israeli history. What has changed since last August is called Donald Trump. And right now, far more than last summer, the wind is blowing in the direction of the far right and the ultra-nationalists everywhere. Of course, Israel too. So that has changed, because when I wrote this text, we were thinking or hoping that Kamala Harris would win the elections. That was not to be. And right now, the forces of extremism are incredibly powerful. Maybe Israel, just maybe, I don't want to sell you a corny optimism or an unbased hope, but maybe the way Israel was a pioneer in the rise of the populist right, it might also become a pioneer in coming out of the rule of the populist right. Hopefully in the coming elections, assuming we will have elections, even that is not self-evident anymore, but let's assume we do, a majority of moderate Israelis would oust the Netanyahu, Ben-Gvir, Smotrich government. If so, we might be leading a little light, a little candle in the direction of overcoming right-wing populism. I can't promise, but this is a possibly doable hope.
We have seen the freeing of the hostages, of some of the hostages at least in the last month, and this has brought at least some moments of relief in Israel and for everybody involved. Is that a success of the Netanyahu government?
No, it's an outcome of the Trump administration. And I, for one, treat Donald Trump like a power of nature, a tsunami, a hurricane. He could go in different unpredictable ways. It so happened that he listened to the pleas of certain people close to him and helped to release our hostages. Unfortunately, also, people returned in a coffin, including, you know, we've been bereaved in so many ways, but Oded Lifshitz, the kibbutznik, the peacenik, the guy who with his wife was also taken hostage, would drive sick people from Gaza to Israeli hospitals, and the uncle of a dear friend of ours. He returned in a coffin, and not thanks to Netanyahu. I would thank Trump, but I don't see Donald Trump as a moral agency in any sense. He is the hurricane. So the hurricane brought back some of our hostages, if it had been up to Netanyahu. And that is what my dear German friends have to understand. The hostages would remain, the fighting would continue, and the agenda of Israel's most extremist right to conquer Gaza, to demolish Gaza, to settle in Gaza, would have become a fact because of Netanyahu's greed for power, because of his desperate need to remain in power. So yes, we have to be thankful to Donald Trump, but not as a moral agency.
In the text we heard, you are very strongly making the case for the two-state solution, and that is what you defend and that is what you fight for. It's obviously not very high on the political agenda at the moment, but can you still give an overview of what, and go a bit more into detail of what we heard already? Why do you still believe the two-state solution is the solution one should fight for, and what you think are the realistic perspectives for it?
Thank you for the question. And again, I'm trying not to preach the unrealistic, but I have to say the following. You know, when I get attacked from the left and from the right, which is a very interesting balance, it's almost an equal fire from both sides. The right is horrified by the very idea of a future sovereign Palestine next door to a future democratic Israel. They think that after the 7th of October, this solution is dead. On the other hand, from people left of me, or many pro-Palestinians, I hear that the two-state solution is racist, and why not create one state, as my father used to call it, one happy unified family of Israelis and Palestinians. And the answer, again, echoing my father, but with renewed force nowadays, is that we are not one, we are not happy, and we are not a family. We need to divorce for the time being. We need two states from the time being for the simple reason that I do not see any other bloodless solution. Maybe one day, maybe in the next decade or century, the world will begin to shed off the notion of the nation state. I'm not a blind believer of the nation state. It began at some point not long ago. It might end in favor of the United Nations of Asia or of the Middle East or of the Mediterranean or some kind of a world republic as Immanuel Kant was hoping for in the distant future. At that point, perhaps we and the Palestinians can live together. Until that time, two states, hopefully on friendly terms, and hopefully allowing Palestinians to go back to their homes within Israel and Israelis to remain or to settle in Samaria and Judea. Why not? But we need a temporary divorce in order to let both nations heal.
But is it realistic? What about the settlers that would have to be resettled? How do you believe the fundamental problems about this proposal can be solved?
It's going to be as difficult for us liberal Israelis to win the debate with our extremists as it would be for future Palestinian moderates to win the debate against their own extremists. It's monstrously difficult. And that is why, unlike my father, because he lived in a different era now, we are in a different new era. And he was hoping for two states quickly, as soon as possible. Unlike him today, I am forced, and I think he might have been forced had he lived now. I'm glad he's not living to see this, but I am forced to say not tomorrow morning, not next year, but we need to leave a horizon. And what is the definition of horizon? It's a far vista on which you have an unblocked view. I want to remove the blocks from this faraway vista so that when a Palestinian moderate leadership comes forward, there would be an Israeli moderate leadership to meet it halfway. And so my life mission now is to prepare the Israeli public sphere, Israelis like myself, to the idea that one day we will divide the land between the two nations as an open option, as a horizon.
The initial idea for the book came when you became more and more aware that the discussion in Germany on all these issues that we are now covering very in snapshots, that your impression of the German debate was that it's not linked at all to the Israelian discussion. And your book includes longer sections in describing how little in Israel is known about what is being discussed in Germany on all these issues. Perhaps you can describe this a little bit in detail also historically, how you do it in your book, referring to how little is known of the speech of Richard von Weizsäcker.
In some ways, you know, it goes both ways, the ignorance, but I have to admit that the ignorance of Israelis about relationship with Germany is far greater than the German ignorance about Israel. I remember when Tel Aviv publisher asked me to choose one German text, translate and publish as a book in Hebrew. I chose two essays, one by Habermas about citizenship, and one is the famous speech of Richard von Weizsäcker in the Bundestag in the mid-80s about German responsibility, not guilt, responsibility in the coming generations for Israel. And I was amazed to see that these texts had never been translated. You know, we teach our students at university, but the public knows very little about the epic story of German-Israeli relationship since 1966, since the first visit of Konrad Adenauer, the first exchange of ambassadors until today. And thus, on the one hand, I have to talk to German friends who tell me, how dare you say bad things about the government of Israel? You are helping the anti-Semites. And on the other hand, I talk to Israelis who tell me today, we are not interested in German politics. We are not interested in who will be the next chancellor, as long as he's a friend of Israel and not an anti-Semite. To which I answer, a friend of which Israel? Because it's time you, our German friends, chose. You have to choose between two Israels, between the current government of Israel, legally elected government, legally created coalition, and Israeli civil society. And I have to make it absolutely clear. We in the Israeli civil society, I don't know if we are just over 50% or just under 50%, the elections will show, I hope. But we Israeli civil society believe, and I'll be as clear as possible here, that the Netanyahu government has gone rogue, is no longer a legitimate government. Now, I'm not becoming a rebel tomorrow morning. We are discussing very seriously in several groups an orchestrated civil disobedience by many Israelis. And the reason we haven't done it so far is that civil society itself is beaten and traumatized and bereaved after the 7th of October and ongoingly. We do not just need friendship today. We need tough friendship. Some people call it tough love. We need the future German government and the future chancellor and the future minister of international affairs to tell Netanyahu exactly what you think about him, to sanction, hopefully not the Israeli society, not Israeli academia, which is 85% liberal, democratic liberal, to sanction directly the government and ministers of the current Israeli ruling coalition. I have said it politely before the 7th of October, when they began their so-called judicial overhaul, which is a cover phrase for a coup d'etat from above. And I am saying this bluntly, no longer politely, after the 7th of October. If you are pro-Israel, you can no longer be pro-Netanyahu. And you can never be pro-Ben-Gvir or pro-Smotrich and their ilk. We need you on the side of civil society. And I'm hoping that the incoming government of the Bundesrepublik, the incoming coalition, would listen to this voice. Even if Israelis are too tired and too grieving and too traumatized to make this voice abroad. And that is my mission, to make the voice of this part of Israel, our only civil society. By the way, because on the right wing, there is no civil society, not in the sense that we know. It is acting like a sect. It is acting like a sect of Netanyahu followers. So please be friends of Israeli civil society by withdrawing your friendship to the Netanyahu government. Unfortunately, he's been invited here by Friedrich Merz. Hopefully, not yet.
Give us an insight of how much actually you become aware in Israel of what is being discussed and happening in Germany.
Very little. Israelis, most of the people in my own circles, and I think beyond, are not only emotionally unavailable, but cognitively unavailable to much of the global discourse in general. Emotionally unavailable to the victims in Gaza. You know, my best friends, wonderful people, tell me, I know, but I can't. I can't empathize, I can't stand up, I can't demonstrate, I can't. I'm too busy with our own crisis, with our own grief. And certainly when it comes to Germany, the only question interesting to people, as I said, is the new chancellor a friend of Israel? I'm trying to make my fellow Israelis understand that we need the future chancellor to be a friend of our sort of Israel, which still exists, which is possibly likely to win the coming elections. Maybe not for long, because, you know, the extreme right and the ultra-Orthodox have much bigger families. But for the time being, if we get the help and the support we need, we might just about enter a last window of opportunity to revive liberal democracy in Israel. And obviously, we need German help for that cause.
Civil society always needs freedom of speech, which I wanted to briefly discuss with you. You make so much experiences on your X account about on how expression of speech works and sometimes doesn't work. You are exposed to threats which don't make life easier. We could read a couple of weeks ago, which of course for publishing houses always of interest, that the bookseller was threatened and detained and controlled of what they sold. Can you talk a bit about your perspective on freedom of speech in Israel and your personal experiences being such a exposed protagonist of civil activism?
Yes. Well, just a word about Twitter or X. If you are not on it, please don't go there. If you happen to be on it, please follow me. But when you follow me, you will see terrible things being said, both from the right, from the so-called pro-Israelis, and from the left, from the so-called friends of the Palestinians. But in between, there are still a great many good moderate people on Twitter, on X, which are worth speaking to. So this is why I'm there. It's no longer the polite public sphere. You know, Professor Coca is sitting here. The polite public sphere invented in the 18th century, where people could speak politics, in talk politics in the salon or in the polite newspapers. Not anymore. So now we live in a much rougher neighborhood. And if we want to be effective in public speaking, we meet thugs. We meet verbal violence, sometimes not even verbal. Now about Israel and free speech and about the case of the Jerusalem bookshop. You know, you were asking me before when we were talking, Jonathan, how does it feel on the streets in Israel when you come out of the house? What does it feel like? Is it still a democracy? Is it getting towards something worse than that? And I have to tell you that where I live, in my little town between Haifa and Tel Aviv, and in Haifa and in Tel Aviv, it is still in many ways the old Israel. Speech is free. Demonstrations are assertive. The population is liberal, although most of our protest energy these days goes towards freeing the hostages. So, of course, we cannot yet build up a further road after, as long as the hostages are there. But in other streets, in other parts of Israel, things are getting worse. Our judiciary is still free. Our attorney general, Gali Barav-Miara, of whom we are very proud, the Supreme Court. But unfortunately, some of the executive powers, including the Israeli police, have gone over to the extremists because Benjamin Netanyahu had the audacity to appoint Itamar Ben-Gvir as Minister of Internal Security, the minister responsible for police. And very quickly, he's now left the post, but very quickly, he undid all the leadership of the higher echelons of the Israeli police, and put extremists in their place. And you see this on the ground, in the demonstrations, even in Tel Aviv. The police is behaving totally differently than it did throughout the history of Israel. So people are getting beaten up. My neighbors, an elderly couple, my son, a young man, beaten up by police standing on the sidewalk, not even blocking the road. This is happening. So it has not broken the spirit of Tel Aviv, but it's a totally different atmosphere. When it comes to Palestinians, both Israeli Arab Palestinians and in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, the police allows itself violence way beyond any democratic red line. So when Mahmoud's bookshop was raided by police, it was about 3 weeks ago, these Ben-Gvirites did something that no Jew has done ever, I think, in Jewish history, that is throwing books on the floor. There were photos of books on the floor. I have to say it, because that's what we are fighting. They tried, they were not able to read either the English or the Arabic titles of books to see if there is any illegal material there. By the way, there isn't. All the books in this Palestinian East Jerusalem bookshop can be bought on Amazon.com. The police used Google Translate on the spot to try to read the titles of books. And yes, there are some books there that make me feel very bad. There is Noam Chomsky. There is Ilan Pappe, there is Norman Finkelstein, there are anti-Israelis. Also, Amos Oz is there on the shelves. Also, David Grossman is there on the shelves. We put together a fight, a petition of Israeli writers and poets and actors and other culture players. We reached, within a few hours, 1,000 signatures. The next day, Mahmoud and his brother were released and no charges have been brought against them. So that battle we won, but this is one battle in a long war.
Thank you. Perhaps one more turn towards the United States. What are the reactions in Israel towards the latest proposals of the Trump administration or of Donald Trump personally about the future of the Gaza Strip?
Well, you know, in Israel you have two distinct bubbles these days. I don't know which one is larger. There is a bubble of us liberals, academics. We know something about the abuse of the internet media. We know something about the new abuse of AI, of artificial intelligence, which created Donald Trump's video on Gaza. We are strongly against this whole new populist front and Trump himself. Now, there is another bubble in Israel, which are the people who are totally caught up in the Netanyahu media. And what we have now in Israel, a little like the United States, Fox News and the area, a little like what happened in Hungary, we have a kind of a totally impenetrable bubble of media for the believers of Netanyahu and the extreme right. They have a television channel, Channel 14. There is now another television channel, 24. They have their newspapers, their websites, their social media leaders, and so on. And I know that certain people, not of my milieu, but certain people I know about, are completely caught up in this Fox News on steroids, really, with the lies, the fake news, the fake facts, and so on and so forth. Now, most Israelis are not in either bubble. They are simply confused and traumatized and injured and unable to follow the sophisticated aspect of international news. So yes, there is an Israeli majority supporting Trump, telling the pollsters, we support Trump, because they think that Trump is a great friend of Israel's. I belong, obviously, to the skeptics, and I think that very soon this typhoon called Trump will turn over from so-called support of Israel to play with a new toy, maybe Russia and Ukraine. So we have to wait and see because it is totally unpredictable. But what I said in my opening about nuances, the worst aspect of a democratic regression, as we are getting today in Israel and in other Western countries, the worst aspect is the abandonment of sophistication, of the nuance, of the educated mind. It doesn't have to be high education. People can finish high school and be reasonable. People can be professors. We have some of those back home and totally extremist and fanatical. But the mind geared towards the nuance, the complexity, is disappearing. So if we want to reinvent liberalism, the first thing we have to do is to find a way to spell out complex truths in the digital media. And this is what we are trying to do in the different protest groups that Ellie and I take part in. We are trying to convey a complex worldview to our fellow citizens.
And you find that possible on Twitter?
From my experience, yes.
Through ongoing communication?
Yes. So tens of thousands of followers who are moderates from all over the world, by the way. I've got people from Japan. I've got people from Latin America. But what is common to most of my followers is a kind of a moderation, a capacity to see the nuances. So it still exists, Jonathan, just about.
What, of course, keeps Germany also very busy at the moment is the war in the Ukraine. What is the current position of the Israeli public as far as they have it at all, and of the government towards this conflict, which is not directly their conflict?
It's quickly becoming opposing because, unfortunately, our government is following Trump step by step towards an anti-Ukrainian position. But a lot of the public is still very staunchly pro-Ukraine, pro-Zelensky. And interestingly, you know, we've had a great, a very big migration from the former Soviet Union in the last 3 decades. A lot of people come from Russia that are not Putin supporters. And of course, people forget, quite a few of the new immigrants are from the Ukraine too. Ukrainian Jews, like my own earlier generations. And so I'm glad to say, because nothing is self-evident anymore, but I'm glad to say that most of the Israeli public is still pro-Ukrainian. And we will have to see how the Netanyahu media henchmen are working out this sudden turn towards Putin on behalf of the Israeli government. But I'm hoping that this will be one thing among several that will make people disillusioned with regard to the Netanyahu government, that they will at some point understand that we are talking about not just an immoral, but a non-moral government, which is in the business of power mongering. So on this, at least, we still have anti-Trumpists in many parts of Israeli society.
I have one last question, Fania. Apart from doing what she's describing and apart from fighting, she has also lately edited a volume of texts of Amos Oz, which we hope to publish as soon as possible.
Yes, thank you. Now you are making me smile at last. I usually smile when I give talks, but not on this topic. So I'm continuing my father's legacies in several ways. And this is one of the best because we realized, his family, his friends, that he had many, many oral presentations, which were recorded, or we have in his archive, in his legacy, we have his handwritten. He hardly ever typed. He didn't know what a computer was, but handwritten notes for these lectures, and we have many of them online in video. But these are new texts for publication. And so what we did was write them down, not change a word or hardly a word, so that his speaking voice could be heard. And we will all be able to read new text by Amos Oz in Israel. It is coming out in May, hopefully then in German, and after that in English. So I'm letting him speak once more. And I think we need him, don't we?
We do.
Thank you so much.